Well, you know, we are coming to say, you know, yesterday and all the days that come that we need to, that, you know, we are not going to stop. You know, we've come way too far. We're not turning back. You know, Vermont has passed a law saying that healthcare is a public good and that they have a job to take up this financing report.
We will leave it there. James Haslam, director of the Vermont Worker Center. That does it for our broadcast. 29 people were arrested in the sit-in yesterday. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. Happy to be with you here live in the studios. It's 2015. So exciting. Our second show of 2015. And I just looked at our station official WHFR station logbook. It's our 11,000th, if you can say it, day of broadcasting. 11,000 days. Wow. And, of course, 30 years, and we're still just getting started. That's right. WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Independent, non-commercial, that's us, from Henry Ford College, all volunteer, student, and alumni staff. But thank you for tuning in. Our show is all about local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Well, several things happening in the big world. That you've already heard something about. One of the big slogans the last couple days in the international news, a terrible tragedy, of course, the assassinations of journalists at Charlie Hebdo. And that's a satire-based magazine / newspaper in Paris. Well, I just thought as a perspective on this, and certainly the attack and the killings are very bad because, well, they're murder, okay? You're taking people's lives. That's just wrong. I think, at least in the Judeo-Christian big books, like, you know, the Old Testament and so on, the number one sin is killing. The number one, numero uno. And it's interesting that it's not qualified there. Well, killing in war is okay. Oh, that came up later. That was a political thing within the Catholic Church where they wanted to get the church, above ground, as they say. This is about, I remember the date, 300-400 AD, whatever, in Rome. The Roman Empire was constantly harassing and prosecuting and persecuting and prosecuting Catholics. So it was an underground religion, if you will, and they wanted to get formal and above ground and have nice big churches, I guess, instead of little caves. And, don't blame them for that part. But the deal they made with the Roman Emperor was, okay, we'll let our Catholics be your soldiers in your wars. We'll let them kill if it's good for the Roman Empire. Well, excuse me, I know the New Testament is not the Old Testament, but if the New Testament is all about love and forgiveness more, because the Old Testament had sort of a God figure that was pretty nasty at times, pretty vengeful at times. And so the sort of concept of God in the New Testament Judeo-Christian Bible is a lot less present, a lot softer, if you will. Doesn't step in as much to do vengeful things. But it's interesting, in the Old Testament, that's where the Ten Commandments are, and oh boy, the number one thing you should not do is kill. And it doesn't have any qualification there. It is a big time sin, numero uno. You don't kill. You don't kill even in self-defense, although that's understandable, to protect yourself and or your family. I'm not sure about protecting your property or your dog, but I'm just, you know, exaggerating here for, I think it's what they call invidious comparison. Playing a little bit of satire, of course, in the spirit of Charlie Hebdo. Anyway, here's an opinion from David Brooks, who is a conservative, a Republican-type, middle-of-the-road Republican-type person, a commentator, op-ed person at the New York Times, though. And he says, I am not Charlie Hebdo. And here's his point of view on this. The journalists at Charlie Hebdo are rightly being celebrated as martyrs on behalf of freedom of expression. But let's face it, if they had tried to publish their satirical newspaper on any American university campus over the last two decades, it wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds. Student and faculty groups would have accused them of hate speech. The administration would have shut them down. And that's because the administration gets criticized, folks. You know, they can't take the heat. They don't want the bad public image for them. Because they basically fund the campus. They fund the buildings and electricity, and they allow, if you will, the groups like the newspaper and that to be there. So in with all due respect, they own the newspapers, and anything that bad happens, they're not going to back you up. Now, luckily, to use a direct comparison, nothing bad has happened at WHFR over the years. We've had our ups and downs a little bit, but nothing that, you know, soiled the public image of Henry Ford College. And so until that happens, we have been granted pretty much free speech. And the only exceptions are that we should follow the FCC rules about speech, and the FCC doesn't actually, the federal government, communications commission that we're licensed to, doesn't have any rules against hate language, although we do, because we know the college wouldn't allow that. So, and, you know, I'm all for having all kinds of points of view expressed, but I think it has to be in a certain somewhat disciplined and rational context. Without vitriol, look it up, without hateful, angry, vicious, and perhaps violent responses requested. All right, so David Brooks goes on, public reaction to the attack in Paris has revealed there are a lot of people who are quick to lionize those who offend the views of Islamic terrorist in France, but who are a lot less tolerant towards those who offend their own views at home. Americans may laud Charlie Hebdo for being brave enough to publish cartoons ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad, but if Ayan Hirsi Ali is invited to campus, there are often calls to deny her a podium. So this might be a teachable moment, David Brooks suggests. As we are mortified by the slaughter of those journalists in Paris, it's a good time to come up with a less hypocritical approach to our own controversial figures, provocateurs, and satirists. The first thing to say, I suppose, is whatever you might have put on your Facebook page yesterday, it is inaccurate for most of us to claim Je suis Charlie Hebdo, or I am Charlie Hebdo. Most of us don't actually engage in the sort of deliberately offensive humor that the newspaper, that newspaper, specializes in. Most of us try to show a modicum of respect for people of different creeds and faiths. We do try to open conversations with listening rather than insult. Yet, at the same time, most of us know that provocateurs and other outlandish figures serve useful public roles. Satirists and ridiculers expose our weakness and vanity when we're feeling proud. Of course, the biggest name I can think of in terms of satire is, or has been for the last 9 years, Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report, which is not continuing any longer on Comedy Central. That same person, Stephen Colbert, as he used to be known as, he will be taking over The Tonight Show sometime in 2015 from Dave Letterman after Dave retires. And he has said he will not be the same caricature of a wild and crazy right-wing person, which is so exaggerated that if you don't know that he's doing satire, you might think he actually believes some of those things, which, of course, he doesn't. He hopes you get the satire, which is way exaggerated. And if you don't get the exaggeration, then you'll think he actually believes what he is saying. Satire is tricky. A lot of people don't recognize it when they hear it or see it. In any event, but I think Stephen Colbert, for those that understand that he's doing satire for the last 9 years, he had a very significant and important role in our society. Even Jon Stewart, who does The Daily Show, still on Comedy Central, Monday through Thursday nights. He doesn't do satire, but he does humor. And he makes fun of left-wing people, right-wing people, middle-of-the-road people. Anybody that's doing something really stupid and ridiculous and or harmful. And good. We need that. We need a lot more than that, too. I don't think there's enough people that are pointing out our foibles in a humorous way, and not suggesting that the people who are not up to normalcy, in their view, should be killed. Nobody goes that far. That's not the point of humor. Not even the point of satire, good satire. So who knows what happened, what the exact cause was in France at that newspaper. So David Brooks concludes. He says, first of all, he says that laughter is one of the ultimate bonding experiences. If we can laugh at our own problems and laugh together, then we can help to, I think, rebuild together. That's my opinion. And remember, all opinions on the new WHFR Journal are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College. He says, if you try to pull off this delicate balance with law, speech codes, and banned speakers, David Brooks says, you'll end up with crude censorship and a strangled conversation. It's almost always wrong to try to suppress speech and erect speech codes. Healthy societies, in other words, don't suppress speech, but they do grant different standings to different sorts of people. Wise and considerate scholars are heard with high respect. Satirists are heard with bemused semi-respect. Racist and anti-Semites are heard through a filter of opprobrium, okay, we don't want to have it happen, and disrespect. The massacre at Charlie Hebdo should be an occasion to end speech codes, and it should remind us to be legally tolerant towards offensive voices, even as we are socially discriminating. That's the opinion of David Brooks in New York Times as of today, today's edition. Just like Ralph Nader said last week, I spend 2 or 3 hours a day reading latest papers, and of course the New York Times is one of them. You got to keep up somehow. Okay, also in national news, you probably heard it on Democracy Now! In the last hour. Obama has proposed in Tennessee, that all across the country, the federal government should pay for 3/4 of the tuition at community colleges for those people that qualify and continue to qualify grade-wise. And that will help a lot of people to start getting a college education. And many community colleges, they have 2-year vocational programs, if you will, certificate programs of one sort or another, as we have, 50 or 60 or more, I think, here, in addition to 110 degree programs, 2-year degree programs here at Henry Ford College. And, the last 25% of the bill would go to the individual states. But how much are they saving in the long run? Amazing. And how much are they doing? How much are they putting back, therefore, pay ahead, as they say, pay forward, for the good of that state? To have all these new educated people in the workforce without debt, without major student debt. You know, student debt is the number one type of debt in terms of dollars in the United States of America. Yep, it's more than home mortgages. It's more than car loans. Student debt. Well, that's not right. that's just not right, that these people are chained to pay those debts off. So they're forced into poverty for all their life, even if they have a decent job that previously would have gotten them a middle-class existence. They're in poverty because of the debt they have to pay off for going to college. It shouldn't happen that way. The costs are outrageous compared to what they used to be. And yet, yes, somebody's got to pay the bills. Last week, I did that breakdown on how if we had free college tuition for the whole country, for even people that wanted to go to public four-year schools, private schools, well, that's your choice. I don't think we should pay for tuition to private schools. Or if we do, we just give them the same amount we give to if they went to a public school. Figure that out, average it out or something. Anyway, the article pointed out that the calculation was that it's only $15 billion more. $15 billion, I didn't say trillion, I said billion. And already, just in fighting ISIS this year, we spent $110 billion. $110 billion fighting ISIS over in Afghanistan or Iraq or somewhere. What are we getting for our money? Nothing here in this country except dead and maimed soldiers. Or it's protecting us. It's not protecting us halfway around the world. I totally disagree with that. Oh, we got to fight them wherever they are. There's so many bad people in the world. Luckily, they're not here, and they're not going to easily get here. If they get here, we'll get them. Okay? But, you know, we cannot be the policemen of the world. Because we don't have the money, first of all. We just don't have that kind of money. But we've got $15 billion, if we stop doing ridiculous things, to pay for all college tuition for all students who work hard to, first of all, get admitted, and secondly, to get at least a passing grade in their classes to stay in college. We owe that to all future generations, to have a highly educated group of people with no lifetime debt that forces them into poverty level, even if they have a decent job. That's just wrong, wrong, wrong. And you know, it almost sounds like you shouldn't go to college because you're going to be living in poverty anyway, even though you may be a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, but you got to still live in poverty because no matter how much you bring in, you still can't afford to pay off your college loan quickly, if ever. So will the Republican controlled House and Senate in Washington, D.C. allow such a bill to pass? Absolutely not. I mean, I hope so. But no. No, even the Tea Party people think, oh, war is so good. This is the best thing we can do for our country. They won't put in the extra amount of money that this might cost. And it's certainly not going to cost $15 billion. That's the cost figured to pay for all higher ed tuition. For all the students going to college, only $15 billion a year. Oh, Michigan highways are going to take $1.8 billion now for the next 10 years. Michigan highways. Now, I know we need highways. Okay, right. Somebody said to me the other day, well, you know, Michigan's got a lot more highways than other states. Well, maybe more highways than Montana. It's true. But Ohio? And besides, most of those highways, you know, not all the highways in Michigan are state owned and controlled and maintained highways. We've got a lot of county roads that are in bad shape, a lot of local city roads. I drove in West Dearborn today in a neighborhood where the streets are just full of potholes, just totally crumbling and falling apart. Well, that's the city of Dearborn. Always has been, always will be. So what you going to do? You put the money out for what's needed. That's what I say. And to pay for college tuition collectively across the whole country. Yeah, two-year school, that's a start. Although trying to get some states to kick in that extra 25%, that ain't going to happen. Okay. You know, the heck with those people. They want to be educated. They need to pay for it themselves. Duh. Yeah, that bad for the state, bad for the country in the long run. Especially with, you know, costs being what they are. Okay. Good luck on that. Where the state address, state of the union address, excuse me, is about 3 weeks away. I don't have the date in front of me, but this is going to be described by Obama a lot more as one of his key proposals. Oh, I do have it here. It's January 20th. So circle that date in your calendar. We'll see how much he stresses this and how much he's going to try to push it in the next congressional session. I have no hope whatsoever for Republican support, and shame on them for giving me no hope. Shame on them. Okay, sticking with something nationally still for another minute here or two. We like to follow sometimes in the show the exploits, the public performances of a performance artist whose name is Billy Talon. Reverend Billy, he calls himself, because he gives sermon-like lectures in public places, and very often about corruption in government, the evils of Wall Street, the pollution caused by certain industries like the coal industry. And he's been arrested multiple times for causing a disturbance, for expressing his views in no uncertain terms in a variety of places. And here's his latest email. He was arrested and spent 21 hours in solitary confinement in New York City in this week. And so the subject of his email is good to be free after 21 hours in solitary. And here's what he says. When a great city struggles for its soul, then strange things happen. September 11, 2001 was surreal, watching the buildings fall. By the way, Reverend Billy is based in New York City, where his Stop Shopping Gospel Choir performs every weekend. And he lectures in sort of like a church-type setting, but he's not a church, he's not a religion. Nonetheless, he's got some good things to say. He says, it is fitting that the effort by citizens to regain our balance after five militaristic Republican mayoral terms will be strange, too. This is how strange. And, of course, New York City now has a Democrat, Bill de Blasio, as their mayor. So here's his example. He says, I shouted Black Lives Matter a few times in Grand Central Station, that's their train station in New York City, and police rushed at me like I was a fiend. Before us were the names of the unarmed police-killed citizens on placards on the floor. He says, you can watch a bystander's video on his website, which is revbilly.com, R-E-V-B-I-L-L-Y.com. Later in the downstairs jail, I asked the police why the upset about a little protest and why disrespect the dead. A thoughtful sergeant posed the question, well, where would it all end? You can't shut down the Grand Central the way you shut down the bridges and highways. There's the problem. They don't see the defense of my right to speak as their work. They won't admit that they will consider the lost lives and their families. No, they consider me a leader, this is Reverend Billy, of an opposing cult. They are territorial. They think of the Brooklyn Bridge as a famous symbol that they lost to a rival group while he was protesting there, with an international audience watching. They see Grand Central that way. But of course, we're not a rival audience watching. They see Grand Central the same way. They see us as a rival religious group. Reverend Billy reminds us, we pay their salary. The police are bound to protect and serve us and to enforce the laws of the land as set forth the United States Constitution. After 20 years of these Republican mayors, New York police never talk of the First Amendment as something that is tangible to them. First Amendment, freedom of speech. The police in our city have a notion of their 40,000 officer community that is cult-like, and they are quite unconscious about it. They are grandiose, afraid, disconnected, and easily led by demagogues, and they carry loaded guns. And yet, last night in the Tombs, that's the big prison there in New York City, the Tombs, they call it, where he was in solitary confinement for speaking in public in the middle of Grand Central Station. No trains were disrupted. Nobody missed their train. But because he was trying to give a speech in the middle of Grand Central Station, they grabbed him, they threw him down, and they put him in the Tombs. He says, I was engrossed with their conversations about the insensitivities of a liberal mayor, about their replays of the murders of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. They are surprisingly caring when they don't think anyone is listening. The cops can be reached and changed. That must happen. It will come from black lives and white lives being unafraid to talk to them in public space. That was always how it was. We have to bravely go to them and change them, and that is a strange transfer, like wrestling with very old culture. Sojourner Truth did it, and Lucy Parsons, and Emma Goldman. They were abused by cops, but they teach us how to change them. When I was sitting in that empty cell for all that time, freezing on that bench, it was my jailer I had to think about. I would shout for some water. Most of the night, my jailer was a black man who was as funny as Chris Rock. I would preach back at him, and we both laughed a lot. But the conversation that we had that might have changed both of us always started with our children. Earthaluja, he concludes, which is hallelujah, but for the earth, Reverend Billy Talon. Interesting person to keep up with. He is a satirist because he seems like a Bible Belt, wild and crazy, no disrespect here, minister. You know, loud, boisterous, ego-driven. But in fact, what he's talking about is something that almost no preacher ever talks about, which is to clean up the environment, to live a sustainable life, and to treat everyone with the utmost respect, love, and kindness. Well, there are some ministers that talk about that love and kindness thing, but never in a way that is as, you know, direct in your face as Reverend Billy when he takes it out into the, what he calls the public spaces. And that's where it all matters. That's where conversation matters. That's why we, you know, not only do this show, we don't do it because it's in the public space, and radio is in the public space along with television. We do it because the Federal Communications Commission said that we need to talk about issues that are of concern to the public at least once a month on the airwaves. That's part of our license requirements, by the way, folks. And so just tossing out ideas here, and this got started with the Je suis Charlie Hebdo issue that's out there, which is in support of free speech. And Reverend Billy, 21 hours in solitary confinement, freezing. Did you know we have jails like that here in the United States? That sounds like some sort of Abu Ghraib. You know, it sounds like Guantanamo or something that they do. Sounds like a torture thing. And all he did was free speech, but in the middle of Grand Central Station, which is very busy with people. That's true. A few people probably had to, you know, walk around him. But it's so noisy in there. I doubt even one person with a bullhorn, which I don't think he had. I see a picture here in the email, attached to the email, and he didn't have a bullhorn. So, moving on. Auto show is coming up in 2 weeks, our North American International Auto Show, which that's what they call it. I still call it the Detroit Auto Show. And big news here. I'm not sure if they're going to be in the auto show, but Detroit Electric. Yes, that's a motor car company. There was a Detroit Electric Motor Company in the 1920s. They sold electric cars in the 1920s. And Henry Ford even bought one of them for his wife. Or did he make it himself in his tool shed? Anyway, Henry Ford's wife, was it Martha? Anyway, no, that's George Washington and Martha. Anyway, Henry Ford's wife, she couldn't crank the starter handle. It was too tough for her. So he got her electric car. And I believe he actually bought it from Detroit Electric Motor Car Company because Ford wasn't making one. They had done some experiments and decided to go with the gasoline engine for a number of reasons. Anyway, they've announced their final design. It's a two-seat sports car, and it's based on the British sports car Lotus Elise, which is what the first Tesla Roadster was based on. You just take the body, buy the Elise bodies, and toss in the electric motors. So this company, which is made up of a few people that used to work for Tesla, they're the bosses, have been working on this a couple of years, and they finally got the design But they've decided they're not going to build it in Detroit, even though their company is called Detroit Motors. They're going to build it in England. And it's probably going to cost, they say right now, first of all, they're not going to sell more than 999 units. And the reason for that is because then they, if they sold 1,000 or more, they'd have to crash them to meet safety standards, I think. And so in order to avoid all the expense and crashing of these cars, there's a couple dozen cars you have to crash or something. It's unbelievable for a small manufacturer. So they can't make more than 999. But the car is going to be safe because the Lotus Elise is out there and for sale somewhere. I think there's a Lotus dealer somewhere in Detroit area. And the prices for this two-seat sports car, just like the Tesla two-seat Roadster, are starting at around $130,000. Maybe we'll see it at the auto show. Our auto show special is I think, 2 weeks from today. Got to check my calendar on that one. I know the auto show starts on the 17th and goes through the 25th in downtown at Cobo Hall. And we'll devote our whole broadcast to not only my own comments about the auto show, but automobile stories in particular. And remember Obama, we remember him, our president. I just mentioned him before. He was here in the last 2 days and visited Wayne, Michigan. And he his basic idea was buy a fuel-efficient car. Even though gas is cheap now, it won't stay cheap forever. No, it's not going to stay cheap very much longer anyway. The Saudi Arabians, who have a lot of the oil in the world, they can't afford to keep it cheap. They're trying to throw some fracking companies in the U.S. out of business by making their oil, which just pumps right out of the ground, no fracking required. They can have less competition if they can force some people out of business short term. But it's, you know, we only have so much oil under the ground, whether we do fracking, which is a danger to the environment. Our governor doesn't agree, but we have 10,000 fracking wells in Michigan and almost no problems at all. We had a couple problems, but nothing really significant as a problem here in Michigan with fracking. Nonetheless, he's right. President Obama is totally right. You don't want to waste any resources ever. You don't want to waste anything. Waste not, want not. My parents went through the Great Depression in the 1930s, and they taught me all these lessons about not wasting anything. Reuse, recycle. Don't leave electric lights on after you get out of a room. Leave a room, even for a brief period of time. So on and so forth. It's good principles, because the less we waste, the more we have in the long run. Okay. Let's look at, it's halfway through the new WHFR Journal show for Friday, January the 9th, 2015. And let's listen to a couple of commentaries from Jim Hightower and Jack Lessenberry.
Perhaps you recall from high school civics class that neat flowchart showing the beautiful democratic process for passing a law through Congress. What a bunch of kidders those chart makers were. To see how the sausage is really made, look at the corporate favors crammed into the budget bill that Congress squeezed out last month, including allowing big coal to explode the tops off Appalachian mountains, then bulldoze the rubble into the valley below, destroying pristine mountain streams. Letting truck bosses require drivers to be on the road more than 11 hours a day, up to 82 hours per week, filling our highways with highballing, sleep-deprived truckers. Turning Wall Street banksters loose to gamble with our government-guaranteed deposits, meaning we taxpayers are back on the hook to reimburse them when their speculative games go bad. None of these corporate favors had anything to do with that How a Bill Becomes Law flowchart in our civics textbook. No bill was filed, no public hearings were held, no debate or even a vote. Just bam! There they were. A thicket of benefits were secretly slapped into the 1,600-page budget bill by, well, by whom? Corporate lobbyists, though they get one of their far-higher Congress critters to do the actual dirty deed for them. The taxpayer subsidy for Wall Street, for example, was written by Citigroup lobbyists, who then got Kansas Republican Kevin Yoder to cram it into the bill. Thus, the Wall Street bank that had grabbed a $50 billion bailout from us taxpayers in 2008 to save itself from its own bad deals essentially was allowed to become an unelected, do-it-yourself backroom lawmaker to make sure that your and my tax dollars will be there to cover its next mess up. This is Jim Hightower saying it's government of, by, and for corporations. And that, boys and girls, is the real flowchart for making our laws. Class dismissed.
Six years ago, when President Obama first took office, the United States was in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Unemployment was heading towards 9%. Barack Obama walked into the Oval Office to find the previous administration had left a budget with a projected deficit of $1.2 trillion. He knew things would get worse. The Dow Jones Industrial Stock Averages fell to less than 8,000 as he delivered his inaugural address. Obama might well have quoted Gerald Ford, who once told Congress, "The State of the Union is not good." 6 years later, unemployment has fallen to 5.8%. The Dow has more than doubled. Inflation is negligible. The war in Iraq is over, and the Afghan war is winding down. For the first time in American history, we have something close to universal health insurance. There's absolutely no doubt that President Obama saved the U.S. auto industry and probably saved Michigan from a new Great Depression. It was no accident that he visited a Ford assembly plant near Detroit yesterday as he revs up for his annual State of the Union speech. That doesn't mean Obama's been perfect. I'm deeply troubled by this administration going after reporters for doing their jobs. I'm unhappy that the president seems to be putting provincial Chicago concerns ahead of the need to stop Asian carp. And I often wish he'd sound more like John F. Kennedy and less like a pedantic law professor. That having been said, given his record, you might expect Obama would be hugely popular. You might even expect talk that the amendment limiting presidents to two terms ought to be repealed. But instead, this president has been the target of a steady stream of hatred, disrespect, and congressional obstruction out of all proportion to anything else I've ever seen. And the reason, of course, is racism. I cannot prove that in the way I can show that unemployment has fallen. I can't prove that George Clooney is sexier than I am either, but I know perfectly well that both things are so. Racism is much like what Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart said about pornography. I know it when I see it. The good news is that it hasn't infected everyone. Obama's approval rating is 46%, which sounds bad, but at this point in his presidency, Ronald Reagan's was only 48%. George W. Bush's was 36%. Obama is the only Democratic candidate for president in the last 70 years to get a majority of the popular vote twice. But racism is being openly tolerated by the Michigan Republican Party. Michigan's Republican National Committeeman, Dave Ajima, well known for nasty attacks on gays and Muslims, posted a shockingly racist article on Facebook. It said that most blacks can't reason, can't control their emotions, or speak English well or without swearing. Top Michigan Republican officials said that there's no way to remove Ajima from that job. Well, find one. I'm not sure why Republicans think they can ask for people's votes when they have as their national representative an openly racist, hate-filled bigot. Actually, I'm a little afraid of the answer.
That'll get you thinking. That was Jack Lessenberry's comment. From Michigan Radio, we thank them for putting that out there as a podcast that you can listen to yourself anytime. And Jim Hightower, of course, preceding him. Yeah, that's politics today. Let's look at local Dearborn scene specifically, even though all these things do trickle down. Dearborn Press and Guide from January the 4th, last Sunday. Dearborn Heights is getting a new alert system. You know, we have something in Dearborn that is run by a system called Nixle, N-I-X-L-E.com. And if you go there, if you're a Dearborn resident and you go to Nixle.com, N-I-X-L-E.com, you can sign up for regular alerts from our police department, maybe even fire department, for emergencies and other things. And you can check, you got some preferences, you can decide about how frequently or whatever. And remember, on your phone or your tablet or whatever, you can set notifications too, to either be loud, soft, you can play music, you can just ring a little bell, or nothing at all until you look, you know, until you check. I'm surprised that the average I just heard the other day was that people check their smartphones for messages 100 times a day. Nice round number. 100 times a day they look at their phone. What's in that? I guess they're not watching where they're walking or where they're driving, and they're certainly not reading a good book at the time. Nope, guess not. Well, anyway, in Dearborn Heights, it's called Ping 4 Alerts. So just check your Dearborn Heights website or call somebody in City Hall, 4-day week, remember, Monday through Thursday, and ask how you, too, can sign up for Ping 4 Alerts. Why didn't they use Nixle? I don't know. Craig Foran has got another great op-ed last Sunday, especially the Michigan legislature failed. I guess he was specifically commenting on what we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, which is they passed the whole issue of fixing the roads to us, the voters. And we either vote to raise the sales tax. This is just, I'm making it as basic as possible. There's some ins and outs on it. Or the roads won't get fixed. So there's a choice for you, huh? There's a choice. Of course, even if it is passed in May, it's still going to take another 6 months or more for any money to trickle in. Not trickle down, but trickle in from the sales tax. So they won't even have the money they need for another year or so after May to start fixing the roads. So that's just wrong, wrong, wrong. And who knows what else they might fail at doing now that we have a new legislature, which has got even more people of the majority party there. So if they can get their Tea Partiers together with their more moderate Republicans, they will be passing things right and left that will boggle your mind, even if you're a Republican. And we'll watch that. But Craig Foran, again, writing a great editorial comment there, an op-ed piece on the editorial page of Dearborn Press and Guide last Sunday, especially. He has something in Wednesday, of course, too. Twice a week he does these things. But I especially wanted to give you the heads up on checking out his editorial last Sunday. Dearborn Times Herald from this last Wednesday, 2 days ago. Official story finally is in the paper, although I think we heard about it somehow in the Press and Guide. But ArtSpace did close the deal on December 30th, 2014. They officially now own our former Dearborn City Hall. Okay, so they got it. Of course, the new City Hall, which is now called the Dearborn Administrative Center, in sort of the middle between East and West Dearborn, its new location on Michigan Avenue there, is has been open for 4 or 5 months at least. That's the place to go if you have any problems with anything and you have to see someone in person. Or have to pay taxes, things like that. City clerk's office and all that is there. And if you have a little bit of money and you want to hear John B. O'Reilly Jr. and Dan Poletko, who's the mayor of Dearborn Heights, talking about their cities, not really a state of the city addresses, but they're summing things up about the business climate especially, that's going to happen next week Tuesday at a luncheon. And unfortunately, it does cost, I think, $35 to $40 to attend the luncheon. I normally get to go there for free if I don't eat food to cover it as a newsman, reporter. But I'm called to jury duty this coming Monday. And who knows, if I get selected and the trial goes more than one day, I can't get to hear the luncheon, but I bet some other reporters will be there, and eventually their story will get in the paper too. And I'll read it and share it with you. But you should be getting these papers yourself, of course, but I'm just highlighting some things to go back and read twice. Dearborn Press and Guide from this last Wednesday. Dearborn Consul said no to deer cull. A deer cull is a deer kill, by the way. Cull is C-U-L-L. It seems like, according to some environmentalists, that the Henry Ford Estate, which is just west of University of Michigan Dearborn, and Henry Ford College, that forest is not just the mansion, but the forest attached to that estate is only big enough to support 10 to 20 deer. Well, apparently there's 40 or 50 deer living in there. And so, as the theory goes, that some are dying. Some are suffering. There's not enough food in there to support them. And we do know that every now and then, like once a year, a deer does jump out over the fence and is found at University of Michigan Dearborn or at Henry Ford College in the back parking lots. But there's nothing to eat here either, so they either get hit by a car or somehow they find their way back into the forest. So it would be a humanitarian thing to have a bunch of hunters go in there and kill 30 or 40. Well, they need a permit from the city of Dearborn to do that because it's in the city limits. And Dearborn City Council just said no. So there. And I'm sure anybody that doesn't want to see deer murdered at random, they say, oh, we're not going to set up any standards like old or young, or we're just going to send the hunters in there and just shoot the first 30 we find. Well, I got trouble with that one, too. So that seems pretty cruel and mindless and heartless. Sorry, U of M Dearborn. Maybe, oh my gosh, you might have to actually take some food for the deer and put it out there. Just as if you're running a zoo. What's wrong with that, huh? Oh, it cost you some money. Excuse me. You're the ones that are maintaining that place. It's part of your property. And I think the animals in it should be maintained by you, too. That's my opinion. I know I'm here at Henry Ford College. Maybe our administration would put in a couple bucks to feed the deer. Who knows? But you can't kill them now. Better not. And you hunters better not come by. Oh, I got a license. They get a license to shoot up north. They don't have a license to shoot on private property. And it's owned by U of M Dearborn and the city of Dearborn. It's not allowed in our city limits. Okay, so obviously hunters would know that. Real hunters, not poachers. So we'll see where that goes. But I just thought it was interesting, without comment, that Dearborn City Council just said no on that. A big concert of Henry Ford College's big band and Midnight Blue is coming up on the 31st of January. And that's fundraising for them. They're getting, with a thanks to local Rotary Club of Dearborn, They're actually able to perform at the Michael A. Guido Theater, the big theater at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on the 31st. And it's a scholarship thing, fundraising. Tickets for reserved seats are $20 each. So you can get your tickets in advance. You go to DearbornTheater.com for that. And scholarships are always important if nobody's giving you a free tuition. And it's a great music performances, too. The big band from Henry Ford College and the Midnight Blue. I think it's a quartet. Kind of interesting. Dearborn Chamber of Commerce announced a travel program along with Colette Vacations. And they're helping to promote a trip to Italy. Yeah. $4,000+ a person. So I don't know why. I've seen a lot of trips since I'm a senior myself offered because supposedly that's what you do when you're retired, is you take trips because you're rich enough to do that. Well, that's $4,000 a person. That's got to save for a while to get that one going. So thank you, Dearborn Chamber, for giving us trips that most average people can't afford. but maybe somebody will do something about that. I know that the Dearborn Senior Organization does have a travel single day, multiple day trips that they have for seniors here, and those are much more reasonable and a great service of your city government. Okay. Let's see here. I don't have something queued up, but I will try to. Okay. What I'm going to do is to, and I'm doing this on the air, and I know it's messy, but there is a podcast called MIRS Monday, and M-I-R-S, that stands for Michigan Information and Research Service, and every week they do about 20 minutes to a half an hour report, and here they catch Governor Snyder at a very sort of innocent moment, and they ask him some very, very good questions. He was really surprised by that. So I'm going to cue it up now. And unfortunately, as I said, I've got to do it on the air. So we'll find it here in just a few moments. Shouldn't take too long. It's a couple minutes in, I think.
You see who's departing, and then you watch going. We got, I think there are some folks, Republican elect.
In 2018, barring any unforeseen health issues, something you can agree to.
Interview that we saved for this podcast, including his position on fracking and airline fuel. And we also touched on government transparency. How come he hasn't been able to get more done from his white paper on that? Let's listen to his comments on that.
Well, John's got the first one.
Okay. Is a promise to Michigan voters that you'll be their governor in 2018, barring any unforeseen health issues, something you can agree to?
Wow. What I view is the whole thing about pledges and promises, I'm not sure that's the best way to operate. So, and I've been very consistent about that on most any topic. What I would say is it's great being governor of Michigan. I'm excited. I just got reelected, and I didn't start all the speculation. So it's one of those things with 2016, it's interesting. They've got dozens of people they have on their list. Mm-hmm. The thing that is a fair statement that people ask me, I think the governors are the best candidates. So, and the third piece that ties into that is I think we should be promoting Michigan more. Not in terms of being a candidate, but we've done so many great things. We should be telling the rest of the world about the great stuff we're doing, not in the context of a campaign, but it would be good for job creation in our state.
For you, there's been talk in the past about a voter initiative to ban fracking in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Some speculate that might come up again in 16. If it does, is that something you'd work actively for or against?
Well, we've been fracking wells in Michigan for years and years. We've fracked over 10,000 wells in the state of Michigan without any really environmental problem, serious problem. I said that once, and somebody found one problem with some permit or something, so I'm...
so you would pose a ban on fracking?
Well, again, to ban it doesn't make any sense when we've been successfully doing it in a smart way. And I actually called for this in my environmental message a couple years ago. Is we actually went out and we've been working with the University of Michigan on looking at the future of fracking and how to be proactive in our regulatory scheme to make sure we're being responsible. Because when I say we frack so many wells, John, fracking has continued to go more horizontal and deeper and doing some variations. So what we've done just isn't good enough in my view. I want to make sure that we are being environmentally responsible. So my view is, so let's be among the most proactive on having smart regulation to be responsible.
Have you ever made any commitments that you would not sign a prevailing wage elimination bill?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I know.
In terms of public commitments, no.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not public, I haven't heard one. How about in talking with legislators? Have you ever told a legislator, I will not sign a prevailing wage elimination?
Well, if it was private and I told you, it wouldn't be private
anymore.
Well,
I didn't say it was private. I just asked if you asked legislators. Okay, let me do a Tim Skubik here, and I'm going to ask this question a different way. What's your position on prevailing wage? Is this good policy for Michigan?
In terms of prevailing wage, I haven't spent any real time on prevailing wage. I tell you, it wasn't on my agenda, but that always gets people smiling now.
Okay, so
it's not been a priority.
Okay, all right.
In 2010, you said there was a dysfunctional government culture in Lansing. That's a quote. Do you still feel that way?
No, I think we've got a culture that's been successful. I think there's always room to improve, but it was dysfunctional. And the representations I would give you is budget shutdowns 2 of the 3 years before I took office. That's not healthy. I'm having an environment where many of the employees that are great, hardworking people, their main date they knew was retirement date. That's not a good answer.
Okay. When we looked at your old white papers, we found one subject where your accomplishments were not as plentiful, and that was on transparency.
You guys do good research.
We keep those babies.
We do.
I can show you my list.
Well, it's an issue. It's an issue.
No way. It doesn't really have them.
Oh, you better believe it.
Oh, look at that. This is awesome.
There it is.
All right. Excellent. So this is...
See,
so these are
a summary of all the white papers, and here's the notes I made.
So we bring up transparency because, you know, as you know, in the election, there was a fair amount of of money that came in that wasn't publicly trackable.
Yeah.
Is that something you would like to see, or like to do more on in the next 4 years?
Well, again, this is where I learned the lesson from the famous Nerd Fund about disclosure, so that was part of it. One of the big ones that I'll be open with, I'll give you one piece that other people don't have at this point that I'm going to emphasize or go after again is the fiscal note question. That's in that section.
Fiscal note?
Yeah, when people do bills about being more responsible. On the whole topic of other disclosures, I'm open to having that discussion with people. I haven't found a lot of support for those things, generally. So it's one of those things that when I didn't get anybody wanting to work with me very much, it just was time to move on. Yeah. But I do keep them alive, as you see. I take this stuff seriously. So over the holidays, I'll be going back through that and roughing that out as part of the next 4 years.
Do you have any feelings on any reforms to redraw Michigan's legislative districts, how we go about the process of doing legislative redistricting? Do you have any thoughts at all on how that's done, if that could be done better?
I'm open-minded to that. I haven't spent a lot of time myself on it. I understand the issue that other places have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd say is that's not something I'm actively working at this point. Because what I'm the things I'm actively working are, one, going back through this list in some ways to make an assessment of what is doable after 4 years of experience in terms of being effective, and then the key priorities being the career tech education, the skilled trade thing that I've talked about a lot, education, the third grade reading and before, and then the intersection between high school and higher ed are the two education pieces that stand out. In addition, I would say the Detroit situation. So three educational pieces in particular. Good government, which would in particular be continuing the budgets, continuing the pay down of debt, but then the local partnership question that I want to be much more proactive. Again, it's how do you avoid the emergency major? What can we do on better accountability and transparency with municipalities and schools? And looking at some of those long-term structural questions. I think that's a pretty good outline of big stuff to go after. Energy policy.
Yeah. You mentioned third grade reading. Do you think that kids, if they can't read proficiently at the third grade level, should be held back until they can read proficiently?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The issue there is I think it's been successful in other states, but it was more a function of they included it in their package, but they did a lot of investment to help people be successful by third grade, if you follow me. Because one of the concerns I get is people just say, we want to hold people back. Well, that doesn't do you any good if you haven't done a lot of intensive or focused investment to actually help people be successful by third grade.
Right.
So the point of holding someone back for the point of holding them back.
At a time when you're asking motorists to pitch in $1.2 billion more in resources for roads, is it a good time to roll back the sales and use tax on airline fuel, aviation, gasoline?
What I would say is that topic comes up, and one of the challenges is what's driving that in some ways is we have an issue with the FAA about the use of aviation-related fuel taxes. So if you look at, we sort of have a conflict potentially between our Constitution saying that extra 2% goes to education and the FAA saying it goes to aviation. So one of the questions I'm spending some time is looking at can you reconcile those two, or what are the options to address that in some fashion?
If it weren't for the legislative requirement that you do so, would you have...
that's trouble right there.
I think you're talking... This is not England or something.
I'm trying to find out what question he's
going
to ask.
Where's this one going?
Would you have on your own pursued a private prison food contract?
What I would say is that was a legislative requirement.
It was. But if it weren't there, would you have
pursued
this issue?
And so I did what my partners told me I needed to do.
This has been a pain in the rear end, hasn't it? I mean, really, it's been more trouble than it's been worth.
It's been a significant effort, yeah, to go through this process. Because, I think we've been, generally, we've done a good job in corrections, and a lot of people don't appreciate, we've made a lot of significant cuts to corrections while still maintaining what I call good public safety and safety for the officers and for public. And one of the reasons the budget number hasn't declined significantly more is because we're now funding benefits and retirements appropriately that shows up in their budget line. So it's one of those misnomers when people say nothing's happened. A lot has happened. We're just doing it in a more responsible fashion.
Is the creation of suspicion-based drug testing for welfare recipients an unfair targeting of the poor?
Not necessarily. My biggest concern is, at first they were going to have it apply to the first time somebody got tested.
Right.
And I thought that was inappropriate. Because my point is if someone's got a substance abuse problem, we shouldn't penalize them. We should help them solve their substance abuse problem. Beyond that, if they continue to abuse substances because they won't get help or they have other issues, that's the point of the pilot is let's see what the consequences are and how we can manage through that in some fashion.
How many changes do you see making in your second term with your top shelf administration?
Not a lot.
Really?
I mean, we've had the couple announced retirements. Again, there could be a couple more, but the good part is I'm really proud of this group. And a lot of the folks, when they first came, said they were coming for a year, 2 years, and almost everybody stayed for all four.
Yeah.
And the good part is a lot of people are fired up to keep going. Because, again, this is an awesome group. I mean, this is the best group of people I've ever worked with. I always use the two criteria to measure it on. One is we have open discussion, where people can share things. And you know this, if you go off the record, that people have told me I'm nuts.
I'm sure.
And I've had a good chunk of them tell me I'm nuts in the
That's
same
a good
meeting.
Headline.
But on the other hand, it's a great group that once a decision's made, and again, I don't force decisions on people, but once a decision's made, we don't have people doing the backdoor stuff or the behind the scenes thing to sabotage decisions. They support it. And that's a great environment. I mean, I worked in the private sector, I worked in a lot of different places, and you can't say that about most places people work to the degree we can here. And that's really proud, especially given the environment.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the whole crew here, Dave Murray and Sarah Werfel, for getting us some time with the governor, and also the Michigan Press Association for sending out this podcast far and wide. Until next week's edition, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
I thought you folks listening to this show would probably enjoy that. We try to let you know about information about politics in unique sources. And MERSnews.com is the place you'd go to sign up for the podcast, although I get mine through the iTunes Music Store. And again, MERS is MIRS. That stands for Michigan Information and Research Service. But their website is MIRSnews.com. And you can listen.